After the movie Free Willy became a hit, word got out that the star of the film, a killer whale named Keiko, was sick and still living in a tiny pool in a Mexican amusement park. Fans were outraged. Kids demanded his release. I'm Daniel Alarcón. From Serial Productions and the New York Times comes The Good Whale, a story about the wildly ambitious science experiment to return Keiko to the ocean. Listen to new episodes on Thursdays. Want early access to the whole show? Subscribe to The Times at nytimes.com/podcasts to listen on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, the president threatens North Korea with fire and fury and says the country best not make any more threats to the United States. And for the first time, scientists in the U.S. have edited the DNA of human embryos to prevent a fatal disease. Why American law may block the biggest medical breakthrough in decades. It's Wednesday, August 9th. Peter Baker, you're in Bedminster, New Jersey with the president. Take us through this remarkable verbal escalation between the president and North Korea over the course of the day.
Well, tensions have been building with North Korea, of course, for weeks and months. It's last month it tested for the first time an intercontinental ballistic missile that can actually strike the continental United States.
Right.
The UN responded over the weekend with new sanctions. And North Korea said today that it was going to respond with physical action to those who were trying to stop it from building its program. Now, that was taken as a threat. And so when President Trump was asked about North Korea today, he responded with a threat of his own, and his language was pretty stark.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. He has been very threatening. Beyond a normal statement. And as I said, they will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before.
That's quite a phrase.
Right.
Very evocative, of course, of a potential nuclear holocaust, and the kind of phrase we haven't really heard from presidents. It's actually more common to the kind of language that North Koreans themselves tend to use when they're making bellicose statements. But in this case, the president decided to meet fire with fire, in this case, fire and fury with fire and fury.
And Peter, how did North Korea respond to that language?
They didn't back off, that's for sure. They issued their own statement basically saying that they would encircle the American military base in Guam in fire. They like this phrase, Sea of Fire. It's a phrase they used again today. And their message is they're not going to back off. They say if the U.S. thinks it's the only one that can wage preemptive war, it's fooling itself that, in fact, the United States is no longer a heavenly kingdom, it said, immune from other countries' ballistic missiles. It was a pretty stark threat.
And just to be clear, that is a threat of some kind of attack on an American territory, whether nuclear or non-nuclear, and it seems rather specific. I mean, it's a specific island.
It's a very specific threat, a very specific island, and it was followed up with the idea that, look, our ballistic missiles are now pointing at the Pacific, and you should look at how far we can launch them, meaning presumably the continental United States.
Peter, do you know why North Korea is threatening Guam in particular? It's not a territory a lot of us think too much about. Is it simply because it happens to be within range and nearby and kind of small, or what?
Well, Guam is actually a very strategic place for us. It's the place where we have a very key Air Force base, and we've used it over the years to station nuclear bombers, for instance, in the old days. And we have used it recently, I think, to fly some strategic planes out of there over the Korean Peninsula to kind of, you know, show force. So it's a place where if there was war in the Korean Peninsula, this would be where a lot of the reinforcements, this would be a lot of the projection of American power would come from.
Peter, you mentioned these sanctions that the UN passed over the weekend against North Korea. How big a deal are those, and what do they do?
Well, they're a big deal mostly in the fact that it was a unanimous vote, 15-0. Both China and Russia, which have often resisted these kinds of sanctions, decided to go along with it. But it is the eighth time the United Nations Security Council has passed sanctions on North Korea, and there's no real sense that it would necessarily make a difference unless China is very serious about it. The sanctions said basically that member nations can't import a whole lot of products from North Korea. That could, in fact, crimp the North Korean economy pretty seriously. But what we don't know is, of course, what China's real response will be. Even though they supported it, they've often in the past not genuinely enforced them in the kind of way the United States believes it should. We've wanted China for years to put pressure on North Korea, and they have often said, yes, yes, we agree. And then in the end, they really haven't, at least not in the way that's changed North Korea's behavior. President Trump had a good relationship he forged, it seemed like, at first with President Xi Jinping at Mar-a-Lago, but lately he's been expressing more disappointment that China hasn't sort of followed through.
And Peter, all this seems to be unfolding with a almost monthly test by North Korea of its ballistic missiles and a revelation each time of how much further it seems these missiles can go. So at this point, how far along is North Korea in its missile development?
Well, it's now tested twice an intercontinental ballistic missile that, in theory at least, has the range to reach deep inside the United States territory, to Denver, to Chicago, and perhaps even further.
Wow.
It has really, I think, taken American analysts and other analysts in the region a little bit by surprise. For years, they've been testing missiles without a lot of success. Now they seem to be actually jumping forward with great speed and a speed that's going to genuinely challenge the United States to figure out what to do at this point.
And finally, Peter, it feels like there have been so many of these escalations with North Korea, and then inevitably they seem to kind of peter out. Like, given the nature of the language used by both sides today and just how amped up it was, and given where North Korea's technology with missiles is, does this feel different, or is this just another kind of rhetorical battle?
It does feel different. It does feel like we have entered into a new stage. Now, what the stage will be, what it will end up meaning, very hard to say. But you're right, there has been sort of a policy for years, particularly under President Obama, of sort of like, let's just ignore North Korea in a public way. Let's not give them a lot of attention, which is what they want. And then through other means, through subterfuge, through sabotage, mm-hmm. try to like prevent them from making much progress on their program. And for years, that seemed to basically keep North Korea in something of a diplomatic box, but it didn't solve the problem. And at some point, obviously, that bill is going to come due. Now, you know, the question is it coming due now under President Trump?
Peter, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks very much. Good talking to you, as always.
We'll be right back.
I'm Jonathan Swan. I'm a White House reporter for The New York Times. I have a pretty unsentimental view of what we do. Our job as reporters is to dig out information that powerful people don't want published, to take you into rooms that you would not otherwise have access to understand how some of the big decisions shaping our country are being made. And then, painstakingly, to go back and check with sources, check with public documents, make sure the information is correct. This is not something you can outsource to AI. There's no robot that can go and talk to someone who was in the Situation Room and find out what was really said. In order to get actually original information that's not public, that requires human sources, we actually need journalists to do that. So as you may have gathered from this long riff, I'm asking you to consider subscribing to The New York Times. Independent journalism is important, and without you, we simply can't do it.
You never know when your heart might fail you with this disease, but it might, and it might kill you. So it's kind of like you're just walking around every day with a gun pointed to your head, never knowing if today's the day when it might go off.
Carl Zimmer writes about biology and genetics.
This disease, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, is caused by genes. In other words, if you inherit a gene with a mutation on it, you're going to make some of the proteins in your heart in a sort of defective way.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just something you're born with.
And it sounds like you're stuck with it.
There's no cure, because in order to cure it, you would actually have to go into people's DNA and rewrite it.
Last week, a group of scientists published a breakthrough that could do just that, edit and rewrite the gene that causes this heart condition.
American scientists, for the first time, have successfully eliminated a genetic disease from human embryos.
Genetic engineering. Yesterday was science fiction, and today it's reality.
The research targeted a heart defect, but experts say in the future, the same approach could potentially prevent a whole list of inheritable diseases.
Carl Zimmer, with this warning in mind that my scientific background is shallow, how exactly does one edit a gene?
Well, this recent breakthrough is an application of a new kind of tool for rewriting DNA called CRISPR. So what scientists did was they created an embryo that had this disease. In other words, one copy of a gene for a heart protein was faulty.
Mm-hmm.
They added in molecules to this embryo, which were able to zero in on the part of the gene where this mutation was that causes the disease. It's like they're paging through an incredibly long encyclopedia until they get to a particular page, and on that particular page, they get to a particular paragraph, and in that particular paragraph, they get to a particular word. They can zero in with that kind of incredible accuracy. And then what they do is they then cut a section of the DNA right there. Scientists can then insert a new piece of DNA to take its place.
So they're removing a word in this deep well of language, and they're actually replacing it with another one.
Right. So then what this cell did was it repaired the DNA, and in the process, it turned this gene into a normal version that you and I have that lets us have normal beating hearts.
And so if this embryo were to become a fully formed human, it would be a human without this terrible disease. Just would be it would be eradicated from the biology of the baby and the adult.
That's right. This is truly revolutionary. I mean, that's no exaggeration.
Wow. So, Carl, tell me about the researcher behind this breakthrough.
The researcher's name is Shukrat Mitalipov.
First name is Shukrat, and last name is Mitalipov.
He grew up in the Soviet Union.
In Kazakhstan, used to be part of the Soviet Union.
Now became interested in studying the cells and embryos when he was in graduate school in Moscow.
And I graduated with straight A's.
And then he came to the United States, started to work with a mentor.
Keith Campbell.
A scientist who had helped to create the first cloned animals, Dolly the sheep.
I remember.
Her name is Dolly. 7 months old, she may not be the monster imagined in a science fiction fantasy.
So many scientists doubted it could ever be done.
I was really shocked. So this was kind of a big moment for me to understand that we have more power in manipulating nature than we think.
For him, what was really important was that this could be a way to cure genetic diseases. What Mitalipov got famous for, first of all, was that he did research on what came to be known as three-parent babies.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. What is a three-parent baby?
It's an idea that bends the mind as well as the established laws of nature. One baby with three genetic parents. And while some call it
it's sort of a label that got stuck on what is actually a way to try to treat really serious diseases.
13-month-old Jessica Newell suffers from a mitochondrial disease passed down from her mother. And doctors say things will get progressively worse.
We only inherit our mitochondria from our mothers. And if there's a mutation in one of those genes, it can actually cause really severe diseases.
Scientists combined the DNA of two parents with the healthy mitochondria DNA of a female donor.
And so that's where you get three parents from.
Understood. So what happened with that research, this three-parent baby concept?
It worked in mice. And so then Mitalipov moved on to monkeys, which are closer to humans. Mm-hmm. There were two baby monkeys that were born that were cured of their mitochondrial disease. So that gave him and others sort of the boost to say, okay, well, let's go to government agencies and ask for permission to move on to humans.
So what happened when they went to these government agencies?
Well, in the United States, they got a big fat no.
Do not do it.
No.
Why?
The United States has been opposed to genetic modifications in human embryos for quite a long time. They have made it very clear that they are not going to approve clinical trials. In 2016, Congress inserted a little line into the budget basically saying that the FDA cannot even consider an application for mitochondrial replacement therapy.
Wow. So, an outright ban.
Yes.
It's frustrating because, you know, this is a goal of my career is to bring new revolutionary treatments. We invested so much into the science and we made so much progress. And now all suddenly FDA was told not to continue this work.
So where is this research being done?
Well, in the United Kingdom, actually, they have gone forward with approving it. And so they are moving forward with this, full steam ahead with lots of regulations and so on. In the United States, it's just a very different story.
So what happened with the three-parent baby, how that research stalled out in the U.S., feels like a cautionary tale of what could happen to Mitalipov's latest research.
Yeah. Yes, that's right.
I understand that we need to draw a line, what's permissible, what's not. We don't want unregulated use. But what we're asking is, let us test it. It needs to be tested in clinical settings.
The scientists themselves have been kind of stunned by how fast they've been hitting these successes. And so, you know, a lot of scientists are really making an effort to try to make the rest of us aware of what CRISPR is and what the potential benefits are and what the ethical issues are and so on.
I don't think, you know, this technology can be stopped at this stage. And I believe this is going to be the future. And this is going to be in national interest of every country. So I think United States have to just reconsider the policies.
It's interesting because it feels like this technology is a bit like the internet or like a big idea that it would be difficult to contain within one country or to keep out of another country, whether a government wants it to be kept out or not, right? Because it will be kind of normalized over time. Is that your sense?
It's really hard for me to look into the future on this one because when you look at, you know, our past experiences, sometimes things go from being really shocking and horrifying to normal. And in vitro fertilization in the 1960s was really considered very scandalous. Most people were against it if you asked them in a poll.
Because it was seen as a manipulation of life.
Right. We did not have the right to do that.
And now it's incredibly common. Practice.
Extremely common, yes. Regulated, it's licensed in the United States and so on. And so it's just a familiar part of life. So, you know, the question is, will CRISPR become a familiar part of life 50 years from now? I really don't know.
So you said this is truly revolutionary in the world of science and medicine. Why is it such a big deal?
You know, scientists have wanted to do this for decades, fix genetic diseases by manipulating embryos. These embryos, they looked like normal embryos. In other words, it's possible that if you took one of these embryos, implanted it in a surrogate mother, the embryo would develop into a normal human being, healthy despite having edited DNA, and in fact would not carry the disease that they had inherited. And not only that, but would not pass it down to their descendants.
I know in the future, these type of treatments will become routine. Probably a million children will be cured of these heritable conditions. And that's what motivates me every day. I didn't want to be an ordinary scientist, but I want the best of the best. I want to be number one. And hopefully I'll show everybody that they are wrong. 100 years from now, they're going to remember, yep, that guy developed it.
Here's what else you need to know today.
The President and First Lady are absolutely fully engaged on a tragedy that is crossing the country.
The Trump administration says it plans to use all the resources of the federal government to confront the opioid epidemic that has claimed tens of thousands of lives, calling it an emergency.
The best way to prevent drug addiction and overdose is to prevent people from abusing drugs in the first place.
The president himself addressed the issue from Bedminster.
If they don't start, they won't have a problem. If they do start, it's awfully tough to get off. so we can keep them from going on, and maybe by talking to youth and telling them no good, really bad for you in every way. But if they don't start, it will never be a problem.
That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.